And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I saw the red light. Did you see that, Phil?
There was a red light. You spoke.
I spoke. If you say, if you, you use spake instead of spoke, you become a classic overnight. It's a,
or somebody from a very obscure mountain village where they haven't had electricity yet.
The spake. That's the voice of Phil Conlon, Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. Phil, today we're going to talk about Will, who is a uniform member, and I would call him a labor activist with a, who blogs and keeps up on major questions. There's a story in today's Toronto Star, Unifor to release full probe into former head Dias. And we follow this story, and I'm sure you're interested in it as well.
Very closely, and I've been following it since day one.
Phil is a union man, and I think the entire union movement, I mean, this is the biggest name, right? And in the latter part of the show, we will try to catch up on the problem with reporting news from the war in Ukraine and the absence of any political leadership in Canada to help resolve the crisis in a manner that will save lives and guarantee mutual security for the nations of Europe. So in other words, we've given ourselves a big job. And I'm going to tell a story, too, about Robert Graves. Please remind me, Phil, because I sometimes don't remember what it was I was going to say. We're joined now by Tony Leah, and I mentioned Unifor, Local 222. Are you there, Tony?
I am, Phil. Good to be with you.
We spoke to you, of course, over the past few months, periodically trying to keep track of a story that first became known to, I guess, members outside the executive of the Unifor national leadership. I first picked up my Globe and Mail, and it said, 25,000 dollars in a bag and a bottle of cologne. And
yes,
I still think that's one of the big headlines. If anybody's going to say what was the headline of the year, I'm nominating that one, because immediately people sit up and reach for their coffee. Now here we are today, and it's been I don't know how many months. I'm going to ask you for background on this, but today's Toronto Star says Unifor to release full probe into former leader Dias. Lawyer says kickback investigation not credible because former president didn't participate. So what do you make of this? This is something you follow very closely. If you could just remind us, when did you first become aware, and why was there a full probe?
Well, of course, information has only been coming out by dribs and drabs because the Unifor leadership has tried to control the story by not releasing information. So initially, I did hear some rumblings that there was something going on, but not a clear picture of what it was. And the first thing that Unifor members heard was that Jerry Dias was on a medical leave. Mm-hmm. And he was being praised by the leadership, and they said he had some serious medical problem, and he was on a leave of absence. And in his absence, the Secretary-Treasurer of the Union, Lana Payne, and other top officers collectively were going to handle the business of the union. So that's the first thing that we heard. We heard that in February, but what we didn't know was that there was already an investigation going on for corruption or bribery or some serious ethical violations. But members of Unifor were not told that, and even the staff and the National Executive Board were not told right away.
Yeah, can I ask you right there, because I'm really glad we kind of work on a timeline, because I was mentioning this, the shocking headline, but of course it had been preceded by the information that he was not well and he was taking a necessary and they hoped successful leave for some reason. Is that right? Is that how his sequence was?
Right. First, he was
and those people leave. Who made that notification, telling the media that Jerry was going to be stepping aside for these reasons, didn't say that there's actually a problem that they were aware of.
No, it seems clear that they were trying to keep it under wraps, which is a difficult thing to do. And every time that somebody got wind of the story, and the Globe and Mail has been the best at ferreting out details, that's when, in reaction, the Unifor leadership made a further public statement once they knew the cat was out of the bag. But it really is amazing that we're now in July and they're talking about releasing the report of the investigation, which was done from January to March. The report of the investigation was complete in the middle of March, and it was shared with the National Executive Board of the Union, although in a redacted form, which is even that is questionable. I mean, why, if there's a report of something so serious, so important to the Union, do you have to censor it and take names out of it before you show it to the elected leadership of the Union? Mm-hmm. But that was back in mid-March, and we're now several months later, and they're saying that they're going to finally share that report with the members of the Union.
And the time frame on that is soon?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
But we don't know how soon possible is, because they don't yes. seem to be very good at figuring out how to share information.
I guess there's a couple of issues to be sort of identified. One is that you have a convention coming up in August. My memory is that, and at which there will be a new leader chosen or
yes.
voted on, a representative vote. And there was a kerfuffle over the wish of Jerry Diaz that he said that he was stepping aside. When he did say he was stepping aside formally, issued some sort of statement. I don't think he was appeared in public or anything, but he said he thought it best for the Union that he stepped down so that they could choose a president before the convention. Am I right?
Yes, it was.
And that was his wish.
That was rather bizarre, yes.
Tell us about that.
Again, the timing always seems to be related to when the news is going to come out. When Jerry realized that the report on the investigation was into him was going to become public, that's when he issued a statement saying he was retiring. And in his statement, he said he was choosing the timing of his retirement only a couple of months before the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. He chose that timing because if he resigned right then, it would require, under the Unifor Constitution, a special convention to elect a replacement president. And he had already endorsed his choice to be the next president, one of his assistants, Scott mm-hmm. Doherty. So yes. he had this all lined up. And he said he thought it was best for the membership. I think he thought it was best for Scott Doherty mm-hmm. to have a quick convention, no matter the cost, even though it would mean that the union would have to hold and organize and pay for two conventions within a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
But he thought it was best so that there not be a long election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And
at that moment, by the way, the executive did not differ with him on that point, did they?
Well, one of the problems we have is that even the National Executive Board or some of the members on it have not been fully kept in the loop. So we don't know. We know at least one National Executive Board member objected to this process of having a special convention. But we don't know, you know, if there were others that objected.
Mm-hmm.
But the really bizarre thing about it is that Jerry thought he could say that he was making this choice to avoid a long election campaign. Does he really believe that the members of the union don't want to consider who the next president is going to be and have an opportunity to listen to candidates and ask them questions and express mm-hmm. their point of view?
Mm-hmm.
He clearly was not doing that because he thought it was best for the members, but to try to manage the process.
Well, now that plane has fallen from the sky, and you just and
yes.
actually the idea has been scuttled, and there's going to be a convention, and there will be a new leader chosen there. And by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Doherty said he didn't want that endorsement. Is that right?
He very much wanted the endorsement initially. In fact, he changed his Twitter handle immediately to say, candidate for national president endorsed by the NEB. He put that on his identification.
So that's
right
where
away.
I got the impression that the leadership endorsed him. Ah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He was quick to brag about that.
But then there were Globe and Star stories, and he decided he had a different philosophy.
Well, there's different accounts, and again, we don't know. We're told that along with the report, we're going to get minutes of the National Executive Board meetings, and that will help solve some of these questions. But I heard or read different accounts of the withdrawal of the endorsement. Scott Doherty published an account, self-serving one, of course, where he said that he asked the National Executive Board to withdraw the endorsement when he found out that Lana Payne was also a candidate for president. I read another account that said the National Executive Board was entertaining a motion to withdraw the endorsement because they had discovered more information that they weren't aware.
Oh boy! Well, that's the kind of thing I want to underline, because will that be in the report? I mean, or the minutes?
Will there be
some kind of record indicating whether they've been forthcoming when they tell us these stories?
Yes, that should be in the minutes, and we should be able to determine which account is more accurate. But the second account said that the motion was already made to withdraw the endorsement, and at that point, Scott Doherty accepted it and said, "Okay, let's unanimously agree that the endorsement is withdrawn." But the argument for withdrawing the endorsement is that when the National Executive Board voted to endorse Doherty, they had not been told and did not know that Jerry Dias was under investigation for an ethical breach. They were told was that Jerry Dias wants them to endorse Scott Doherty.
And they thought, well, why not? Because,
yeah, because the leader, that's the way that things have always been done.
The most visible labor leader in Canada, certainly to the Toronto Star. Jerry could hardly go out of his house without getting a picture taken and mentioned as leading unionist and friend of the Liberal Party. But anyway, now, that brings up, I think we better remind everybody, there are allegations. What is the allegation? And it involves the union, and it involves the police investigation. So what is it that is alleged to have happened?
What is alleged, and this has been stated by the leadership of Unifor when they finally called the press conference to discuss the incident. They said that a company that supplied COVID tests was endorsed or supported by Jerry Dias. Jerry and some of his staff went around to companies that they negotiate with and ask them or were able to convince them to buy these test kits. and that connected with that, Jerry received a sum of money, reportedly $50,000, although I think that's only by his own account.
His
he
own?
Gave, he gave.
Jerry's 20, own account or some? Or
as near as I can tell, there doesn't seem to be any other source mm-hmm. for the amount of money that
that's
he received.
That's right. Some of it, on these allegations, there have been lawyers commenting about denying one thing or another. Did it? That has not been denied.
No, neither.
That doesn't mean that they're
acknowledging,
but at least they haven't made any statement on it.
Well, there's no doubt that Jerry received a sum of money because he put $25,000 of it in a bag and handed it to one of his assistants, Chris McDonald. And apparently he told Chris McDonald that was half of the money. But, of course, there's no confirmation of how much the total sum of money really was, or whether there had been other cases where money was handed over in return for different favors or as a benefit for different companies. And that's one of the things that hasn't been answered yet and hasn't even been investigated yet. So I think it will be good if we finally get to see this report, but there's still so many questions that haven't been answered and won't be in the report because the investigation didn't look into the company that supplied the money and the test kits, didn't look into the other companies which purchased the test kits, didn't investigate to see whether or not there had been other instances where sums of money were handed over. And those are the things that are really critical. It seems extremely unlikely that this would be a one-off. It's just not something that you would expect only happened once.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody to be handing around bags with cash in them, you have to assume, most people would assume that it wasn't the only time that happened.
It's a fairly casual. It's behavior. By the way, they did clarify. They said there was no bottle of cologne with the initials of the recipient, right? Have they denied the bottle of cologne?
So the initial story was that there were two or three bottles of cologne, and that they were had the initials of the recipients. The two of the recipients were going to be two of Jerry's assistants, Chris McDonald and Scott Doherty. So that was in the story. So with all of these lurid details about the bag of cash and then the following 6 days of frenetic activity before somebody finally decided to hand the money over and file a complaint.
Yeah, I wanted to,
that 6 days is really important.
I want to underline that, if we could. According to the Toronto Star story, that the recipient, Mr. McDonald, he said that he was given a bag of cash, $25,000. I guess he counted it, and he reported he turned it over to the union, and made an ethics complaint. Did he do it that day?
6 days later.
Oh, 6 days later.
And during those 6 days,
what was he thinking about for the 6 days?
I'd love to
working
know
on an ethics essay. Go ahead.
There was discussions going on, and I'd like to know what those discussions were. But Noreen Ritzvie, who's the Ontario director of the union, was involved. Scott Doherty was involved in discussions with Chris McDonald. I'd like to know what they talked about during those 6 days, and that was in the Globe and Mail report. And
yes,
the funny thing is that out of all of those things that were talked about, the one thing which Scott Doherty complained about was that his initials were not on the bottle of cologne. And he got his lawyer to contact the Globe and Mail, and the Globe and Mail withdrew that part of the story. But he didn't challenge.
Clarify that one.
He didn't challenge the.
There was
the
a bag of $25,000.
No, and he didn't. He didn't challenge the fact that he was involved in discussions with Chris McDonald during those 6 days.
When they were working on the ethics question.
Or whether that's the direction they were going to go. I mean, who knows what they were talking about.
And by the way, how are we going to find that out? Do you think the report's going to tell us?
I hope that the report
tell you. It's going to be told to the members.
Information about it, but it'll only be based on what those people said. We were told that only four people were interviewed for the report, and so the report can only reflect what those four people said. Noreen Ritzvi was one of them. Scott Doherty, Chris McDonald, and I guess the fourth would be Lana Payne. So we'll hear their accounts for what they're worth. They'll be interesting, but whether they are definitive, you know, people have interests that they're trying to protect in this process. And what really needs to be done is a more thorough, more objective investigation into the whole way of doing business of this union, Unifor, that allowed this kind of activity to happen. There's a culture there of self-enrichment by the top leadership of the union and cooperation with corporations, you know, what they call team concept. Those are the things that really have created an atmosphere in which money can change hands that way. And that's what needs to be investigated. And so far as I can see, that's not what the leadership of Unifor wants to have investigated. In fact, when they finally revealed that there was an ethics complaint, Lana Payne was asked about whether or not there were other instances of this. And she said, "We are treating this as an isolated incident." She didn't say we investigated and found out that it's an isolated incident. She said we are treating it as an isolated incident.
She's a born leader. There are people in high places who need people as help like that with their language. How to avoid something.
And I'd like to remind you and your listeners, Phil, that there have been a lot of members of Unifor who have not been satisfied with the lack of transparency and the lack of investigation, including the members of my local 222, which had a membership meeting in May, voted to send a letter to the National Executive Board saying that a much more thorough investigation needed to be done to find out whether there were other incidents.
Have they got a response?
As far as I know, there was no response. I would think that
that's a new spirit of transparency.
I believe that it may have had an impact, along with other members and other locals pushing for information, in the leadership now saying that they're going to make the report public.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking about this. By the way, I'll remind listeners, this is Tony Leo. He's activist in Local 222 of Unifor, Oshawa, and GM. The investigation was, they said, an independent investigation. So who conducted the investigation?
We don't know.
We don't know.
Nope.
And they spoke to four people. This has just been reported. We actually haven't heard from Unifor's murky executive as to what behind it. The reports were that they spoke to four people.
Correct. Yes, that was reported.
You know, we're talking about quite a bit of money and in a really kind of a shocking circumstance.
Yes.
Four seems like a kind of a small number. What about the issue of who provided it's alleged it was $50,000, 25 of which went to the individual who thought about it for 6 days and then turned it in. The other individual, well, we'll go into him later. But so who gave him the money? Where'd the money come from?
We're told that it came from a company that supplies COVID test kits.
You know, we're talking about a pandemic and a kind of a, this is a whole, our whole damn public is still traumatized by this whole thing. And there's always a suspicion that somebody's making money off a crisis. And one of the things you don't want to have happen is people say, okay, like, oh, you need this, you're going to have to get it right away, and here's the guy to buy it from, right? It's like it's one of the uglier things when you have a public crisis like COVID.
Indeed, and a union, in my opinion, should never be involved in promoting a company.
Yeah, or if they are, they'd have to tell the members and tell the members why.
Yeah, there certainly needs to be a lot more explanation, but apparently the National Executive Board was told that when they got to see the report, that they were not allowed to know the name of the company. So even the National Executive Board members were not allowed to know the name of this company.
Well, that's great. I mean, we don't want to disturb a company that's bribing people. By the way, we don't know which end of this. I mean, the third party, the one who is alleged to have given the money, we don't know whether someone approached them and said, if you give me 100 grand, 50 grand, I'll do something for you. Or did they approach the other way? I mean, that's kind of important, isn't it? Who approached who?
I think it's important.
And who set the number? Who said, what's the number? I hate to sound like a gangster, but you can't do politics in Canada without sounding like one. So who was asked for what? We do have police. They're hardworking on a number of cases unsolved, but they can ask, can't they?
Well, when this started to blow up, Lana Payne arranged for the bag of cash to be handed over to the Toronto police with a request for them to investigate, and they said that they were going to investigate, and we have not heard a word since from the Toronto police.
Not a word.
Not a word, publicly. I haven't heard
anything.
Fortunately,
they're completely independent of politics and never make any decision other than, you know, what the investigating officer says to do. And that's why the rich and powerful tremble when they hear about investigations. They just tremble. Because you notice how many of them are imprisoned for this stuff. None. I'm also interested. The Toronto Star seems to be leaned very heavily on the counsel for Jerry Dias, one of them, I guess. There's more than one, I suspect. I think, maybe I'm wrong. And on the reference to his... they call him, I think, a forensic psychiatrist.
Yeah, it's a new one on me, too.
That's a very interesting one. I mean, a lawyer turns to his assistant, get me a forensic psychiatrist. What, we have a problem? Yeah, I think we got a problem. Anyhow, this was a concern I had. I thought the Toronto Star, maybe because of previous close association with Jerry in terms of lauding him, there's two reasons, one being the Liberal Party is very much favored by the Toronto Star. And then the employees of the Toronto Star are members of Unifor. But I think most Unifor members would be really intrigued with the knowledge of learning that the personal psychiatrist of someone can say to the boss or the employer, I can't come to work because my psychiatrist says I need to take a break. And a substance abuse problem.
Yep.
And the employer says, oh, we didn't know that. Good luck, and of course we'll continue your salary. Is that what ordinarily happens?
Not in my experience, I would have to say. In this case, it's even more bizarre to me. If we go back to the question of the timing, it was in January, towards the end of January, that the investigation began, and Jerry was told that he was under investigation. So that was before January 30th. Mm-hmm. The investigation was completed in the middle of March, and mm-hmm. it was just when the investigation was completed and was going to be handed over to the National Executive Board that Jerry decided that he needed to check into rehab. And that's when his lawyer contacted Unifor and said that he has a medical condition that means that he can't participate in the investigation. But that was a month and a half after the investigation had begun and when it was already complete. Mm-hmm. And from March, the middle of March, another 3.5 months. In that time, the National Executive Board received the report. Based on the report, said that they believed that Jerry had violated the Constitution of Unifor and that there should be a hearing. But no hearing has been held because, you know, Jerry's not up to it. So that's an awfully long period of time in which we're told the organization can't take action against a very serious ethical breach because the person who may have committed that breach just isn't up to talking to them yet.
Yeah, that's, I would think most people would find curious, because in their lives, I do think that most people understand that merely telling an employer or an authority that you can't cooperate because you're a doctor, they tend to say, we better have another look. We'd like another doctor.
Yeah, you better go see our doctor.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really what it always boils down to. And unions know all about this because they have to go to battle all the time about this. Mm-hmm. And also, there are problems that also emerge of professionals who make themselves available for these things, and which is also litigated quite often. But it, in terms of politics of it, watching from outside, the Toronto Star reporting, particularly the big, they did a feature practically on the subject, where the basically the psychiatrist was made the explainer of the conduct of Jerry in such a way that he was a great guy, according to psychiatrists, and probably anything he might have done that was, you know, like giving a guy $25,000, et cetera, was because he felt guilty over not having named him or properly benefited the guy because he had to choose between two of his assistants, Mr. McDonald and Doherty. Mm-hmm. So, and you say, well, you see, the Toronto Star has given me his case, except Jerry hasn't said a word.
Yep.
And so then they brought in a guy who said he's one of the greatest labor leaders ever, and he's benefited everybody, and he's a marvelous guy who just is really tragic. But he wasn't a member of the union. He was a head of an automotive parts outfit in Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
And they featured a quote from him. And when I first read it, I thought, oh, wow, here's a labor guy standing up for his fellow labor guy. But actually, it didn't, you know. So anyway, I would really hope, you know, we need media. But it doesn't this show that you're as well off reading, if I think it was Thomas Jefferson once said, if I had to choose between a government, having a, what was it, a state, having police, or having newspapers, I'd take newspapers. We need reporting of this kind of matter so that everybody can, so that we can pose questions and then listen to the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being kind of carefully guided and orchestrated and told basically nothing. The coverage at this point is still basically Star Globe. And Unifor members who've been speaking up, I should, I guess, mention that Mr. Cassidy, who's from Windsor, he of course, is a candidate. He has a prejudiced interest. We understand that. Has he commented on the, first of all, on the investigation and what he thinks the problem is? He's the only, and I ask that because as far as I know, the other candidates have said nothing other than that they're satisfied with the way the union is handling it. Is Mr. Cassidy satisfied?
I think that I'm not aware of him making any recent statements. He was one of the people who was pushing for the investigation and the charges to be revealed to the members. He said it shouldn't be covered up. And I think that he played a role in the fact that, you know, eventually information got out about what was going on. And of course, yes, he's a candidate, but we have to give him credit for the fact that he didn't accept the leadership rallying around a chosen candidate, as has always been done in the past. he said that regardless of that happening, he was still going to be a candidate and he was going to campaign for the president. And as a result of that, we've seen more discussion about the leadership of the union and the direction of the union than we've ever seen before in decades, I would say.
Yeah.
So I would give him credit for that, and I would give him credit for pushing for more transparency. As to the actual charges, the process is supposed to be that there's a hearing into the charges. And, it's very disappointing that here we are, almost 6 months after this came to light, and there hasn't been a hearing in which these charges can be, the validity of the charges can be determined by the union.
Yeah, that hearing part is that is an interesting touch. When someone says, "Well, my doctor says I can't come to your hearing," if I've got this to describe properly, shouldn't the hearing just go on and say he says that his doctor won't let him? But after all, that they don't have to wait around till the doctor says it's okay.
No, they initially agreed to postpone the hearing when he checked into rehab. I don't know if he's still in rehab, but certainly at some point you have to say, well, we gave him an opportunity. He's not choosing to or not able to participate. We have to go ahead and review the information, the evidence that we have, and make a decision. Because
say what you do know and what you and put the questions that you would have asked this individual were he competent to appear, right?
Yep, yep.
And say, well, he's free to come forward if he, is feeling better.
When a union is dealing with a case like this, whether it be fraud or theft or corruption of any kind, it's not a court of law. It's not a criminal charge. They don't have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They operate on a balance of probabilities. So they have an obligation to carry out the hearing and not delay it indefinitely. And they have an obligation to the members to decide what they think happened and deal with it accordingly. If they feel that there's sufficient evidence that to find that there was any kind of corrupt behavior, there should be consequences for it.
Yes.
And they shouldn't be treating somebody differently because they were formerly the president of the union.
By the way, this is such a fascinating topic. I'm thinking of other aspects. The police probe, which is, I love the word probe. Why did I say that? Anyway, they were asked by Unifor what, I guess Unifor said, this is what happens. You tell us what to do. And they say they're going to investigate. But why wouldn't the provincial government, or maybe even the federal government, Unifor is a cross-Canada operation, be interested themselves? Why wouldn't they say, what? Somebody was trying to make, trying to kind of fudge, take advantage of the pandemic to gouge somebody? I mean, that's an allegation, an unfair business practice. I thought business people thought that was, now that's serious stuff, because one businessman's hurting the other businessman. There's other businesses who didn't get the same help, allegedly. So why are they so quiet? Have you thought about anybody asking it? Why haven't they looked into this themselves? They don't need Unifor.
I believe you're correct, and I don't. I know I certainly can't answer. Why there hasn't been any more evident interest in the matter. It does make an interesting contrast with events in the United States where the UAW, which is the union that auto workers in Canada used to belong to, has gone through a revelation of very severe corruption in the leadership that led to a federal investigation and criminal charges against, I believe, a dozen different high-ranking members of the union, including two former international presidents. who both were issued jail time as a result of that corruption. And it also led to a negotiated agreement to change the administrative structure of the union so that going forward, every member of the UAW will have a vote for president and other top leaders starting this year. So,
pretty dramatic.
A very dramatic result that came out of the corruption charges in the United States, and it's been managed in a way in Canada where we don't know if it's as serious, but it hasn't been investigated, so we don't know. In the United States, it started with charges against one member or one leader of the union, but because it was pursued, then it was uncovered that there was much more corruption going on.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what the case is with Unifor because it hasn't been investigated.
It's fascinating stuff. Is it the timing? We're into July. Your convention will be in Toronto, Unifor convention in August, right?
Yes, August the 8th. The convention.
So, do you have any? You think perhaps there might be some coordination of time so that this investigation will impact somebody's campaign to be president, where people go around saying, "Wow, a great report! Thank you very much. We should make you president."
One would assume that's a real possibility the timing is a factor, and of course, what's in the report is we don't know yet, and whether it benefits one or another candidate, we will find out. But
it might turn on who's behind the microphone, looking open and caring, and reminding everybody what a great union it is.
Yes,
I got the impression that somebody benefited early on from that.
That is definitely the case, I think. But it's also the case, I strongly believe, that Jerry Dias, when he said he wanted to have a very quick convention to choose a successor, and that he was retiring early so that that would happen, I believe that was designed to benefit his preferred candidate, who is Scott Doherty.
Yes.
And Scott Doherty fought very hard to have that special convention happen. And when it didn't happen, he howled in complaint, and I believe was instrumental in having charges laid against Lana Payne for, he said it was a constitutional violation to not have the special convention. So, yeah, there's been, the campaign for the next president is certainly playing into all of these development
will be impacted for sure by this, how this unfolds, and so close to the convention, which is, if there's no report before the convention, you will have people rattling the windows saying, how are we supposed to choose and we don't even know what happened, right? So
yep.
Obviously they intend to bring it out, I guess, perhaps redacted a bit. What do you think?
Well, they redacted it before they showed it to the National Executive Board, the elected leadership of the union.
That was just sort of a warm-up for redaction.
So who knows how much of it the members are going to get to see.
Well, it's not only dancers that know about choreography.
That is true.
We've been speaking to Tony Leah. I guess, Tony, we should hope that Jerry recovers completely and perhaps be invited to give a speech. He could help out if he came to the convention, just to told everybody what happened. And so we'll hope for that. I guess I would just get our hopes up.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the Taylor Report. We're bringing you news, news, news. You notice that? This is, I want to say to the Star, we're following this thing too, and to the Globe. Please don't go to sleep on this. And somebody wake the CBC and tell them what's going on. the Taylor Report, I think why don't we have a little bit of music from Dr. Morgan, one of my favorite people, Lee Morgan, and we'll be back.